welcome to Risky Business, episode 226. I am Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we chat with information security legend, Mr. Dan Gear, about traffic analysis and the concept of digital exhaust. Everything we do online, everything we do digitally, produces a ton of metadata. This is the digital exhaust that we're going to talk about. But what can be inferred through the analysis of this metadata, and who's likeliest to analyze it? Part one of two of my interview with Dan Gear is coming up after the news. This week's show is sponsored by RSA Security, the security division of EMC Corporation. Big thank you to RSA for making this week's show possible. So in this week's sponsor interview, we'll be chatting with RSA's Mason Hooper about the company's 2012 Cybercrime Trends Report. Is Zeus still Zeusy? Is it still, you know, worthy of a godlike name? We'll find out at the back of this week's show when we chat to RSA's Mason Hooper. But first, of course, it is time for a check of the week's news headlines with our regular news guest, Adam Boileau. And Adam, leading this week's bulletin, apparently your foreign minister, New Zealand's foreign minister, got hacked.
Yeah, so according to the Dominion Post, which is a fine and reputable newspaper full of very accurate facts here in Wellington.
I think you need to refer to it as a font of truth.
A font of truth and wisdom, no doubt. reported on the front page that Murray McCulley, our foreign minister, had his emails compromised by anonymous hackers called Anonymous. And apparently they broke into his personal email account at one of our local ISPs, not his parliamentary account, and stole articles and emails and stuff that were being forwarded to his account whilst he was on holiday. And amongst this treasure trove of information, which of course has not been released, were such things as media briefings and other important things.
And there we go. And true to form, Anonymous has not actually doxed what they, you know, they stole the docs, but they didn't dox the docs, which is kind of interesting, which makes you wonder, how do we know this was anonymous?
Well, exactly. I mean, the New Zealand media reporting on this has been, you know, basically having zero information whatsoever. And allegedly this happened in April last year, and we haven't heard anything up until now.
We should point out that it's been acknowledged by the New Zealand Prime Minister that this did in fact occur.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, we have really no other information, but yeah, nothing's actually been leaked out yet. We haven't seen any, you know, WikiLeaks-style cable drops coming out of Murray's extra account.
I love it, you know, because it's the perfect thing to do, isn't it? You're a foreign intelligence service type of dude. You hacks the minister, and then you say, "We are Legion, bye-bye." And everyone goes, "Anonymous!"
Yeah, exactly. Classic technique now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. We are Legion. Or you drop funny cats and pretend you're Chinese. Anyway, moving on. And, you know, if you believe some of the reports floating around this week in the mainstream press, cryptography, that whole cryptography thing, no good anymore. No good, the cryptography.
Yeah, all the cryptos have been burnt down.
That's right. According to this, there's been some research. When in actual fact, there's been some research into RSA-based cryptography, which has found, 27,000 out of about 7 million key pairs, like had kind of some problems because their random numbers weren't random enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really good piece of basic research. They these guys, for a couple of university dudes, sampled all the public keys they could find on the internet, and then did some research into the quality of the key material that had been generated in those keys. And what they found was that some small amounts, about 27k out of a sample of 7 million keys, were effectively weak. They were appears to be the result of, you know, like some kind of poor random number seeding, poor random number generation in whatever piece of equipment was used to generate them. But the interesting thing that came out of the research was that all of the keys that appeared to be weak were RSA, and the types of keys they sampled were across a range. And one of the conclusions that came out of this research was that none of the DSA keys appeared to be bad, whilst many of the RSA keys, or some, a non-zero amount of the RSA keys appeared to be bad. And the implication there is that DSA is somehow less bad, or less susceptible to bad random number sources than RSA. And that's as far as I gather, right? Not being Peter Gutman, I can't actually draw the correct conclusions from the data. But no, it's interesting, and it's really cool to see this kind of, you know, relatively simple research. Let's just get all the keys and do some, you know, qualitative analysis of them. And, you know, that's cool. These researchers did suggest that, you know, given the basic nature of the research, it would be surprising if other people hadn't already done the same thing, drawn the same conclusion, and perhaps done something else with the data.
Yeah, well, you'd think that our friends at the NSA might have looked into something similar. But, I mean, what do we glean from this? I mean, does there need to be some sort of update to the random number generators used in implementations of RSA cryptography? Or, I mean, what does it tell us?
Well, one of the articles I read did suggest that the keys that were bad, some of them were coming for embedded systems. So, you know, I guess like, you know, load balancers and, you know, embedded systems that are, you know, perhaps don't have as much entropy available, or perhaps, you know, don't get the scrutiny that a mainstream platform would. So I don't know that it's necessarily, I'm not sure whether it's a weakness in the way RSA generates keys is more susceptible, or whether it's just there are a bunch of embedded systems that generate keys internally that do so badly. I'm not quite sure which.
But fun research, I guess, really, though, world not ending.
Well, not really ending, no.
All right.
No, I mean, the world's ending for a number of other reasons, but not
yeah,
this one.
That's right. Well, we better move on because we've actually got a lot to get through this week. And Google had this is just such a classic people not thinking when developing an application sort of bug. They had a bug in their Google Wallet application, which was pretty lol-tastic.
Yeah, so I gather from reading this, I've not actually used Google Wallet, that you set up the Google Wallet app on your Android device, for example, and you associate it with your Google account that has, you know, kind of money value stored in it, and that's protected by a PIN number on your device. And you can apparently get access to someone's account by taking their Android phone, resetting the application that stores the your Google Wallet application, and then, you know, re-enroll into it, and then you pick up with the existing account that it was associated with, thus giving you access to it.
Yeah, basically, I mean, you just blow away the settings, and then you load it again, and it asks you to enter a PIN to use, right? So you can you can blow away the PIN and force a PIN reset, which means then you can use that device, and you know, if there's any prepaid credit on it via, I think they embed like MasterCard and Visa, and like, I mean, that's where it's going anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can basically steal credit off it and buy cigarettes and Red Bull and whatever you're into, right, at the 7-Eleven. But, you know, again, if you've keylocked your device, I mean, if you've, you know, then this isn't such a problem. But it's just one of those classic little oops, we didn't think of that issues. And since then, Google has actually fixed it. But it's sort of getting a run as like, oh, no, you know, NFC, terribly insecure, which I don't think is entirely fair. Worth mentioning, Arbor Networks, their PR people were bandying this one about last week. They did their sort of, you know, regular report into DDoS activity on the net and have found, you know, it is actually spreading to the IPv6 net. We've seen the first instances of IPv6 DDoS activity with 4% of survey respondents in this Arbor survey saying that they did see IPv6 DDoS traffic.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I mean, seeing DDoS on IPv6 is no surprise, I'm sure, but it is, I guess, a sign of the times. We're actually seeing some uptake of V6. But I mean, overall, in terms of the security concerns you've got actually deploying V6, man, DDoS is so far down the list.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like, what, we can clog those tubes as well? Right, okay,
yeah.
You know, no real surprises there, but still sign of the times. Worth mentioning. Now, Apple apparently is introducing more sophisticated anti-malware capabilities into its next operating system. What is it? It's like something lion?
Mountain lion.
Mountain lion. For God's sakes, can we stop it with the big cats? Come on. But they've actually brought in, what looks to be a fairly sensible approach in terms of locking down the OS. I mean, Microsoft has always gone for that open platform thing. You can develop apps for it, go nuts. Apple's really bringing it back to this App Store approach, and they're bringing in what I'd call almost a form of digital fascism. They've mandated that all applications sold through the App Store as of March have to be sandboxed. They're tightening up, you know, like a signed code regime. They're introducing some basic signature anti-malware. They're doing system scans, things like that. But it is a different way of approaching the OS security model than Microsoft has taken, haven't it? Isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And I guess you only have to look at the success of the iOS App Store to see why they're doing it. I mean, it makes sense for them to try and try and leverage that onto the Mac OS X platform. And you know, it does seem to be the way that they're going. And you know, we were arguing about this around the office this morning. You know, Pipes was saying, I don't want my Mac to be like my iOS tablet. Right? It's not an iPad. I want an actual computer. And you know, the fact is that these things that Apple are doing, like, they're not for geeks like us, you know, people who want to run random code or, you know, write their own things. Like, it really is for everybody's mums. And in that respect, you know, it does seem to be a good way to go. You know, they're not going to have the same explosion of malware that we saw on the Windows platform because of the openness, and the same thing, you know, with the Android is such a great contrast there. It's simultaneously fascism, and then on the other hand, you know, solves a very real problem for a very large portion of their user community.
Well, so did fascism, right? So it caused some other problems for a few. But the interesting thing here, I think, is that, you know, you're not just restricted to the App Store. If there's a bit of software you want to run, you know, outside of that, for now, I guess, you know, you can still get it. So, interesting approach. And I think, you know, it's really looking at a whitelist approach. And, you know, I think it'll make life a lot tougher for people who are considering porting a lot of the worst malware onto Mac. So we'll just have to see how it all plays out.
Yeah.
Now, lawmakers in the United States are introducing a new cybersecurity bill, which has been watered down a little bit from its original origins. But basically the gist of it is that this bill allows the Department of Homeland Security to work with critical infrastructure providers in coming up with a set of security standards that they need to adhere to. So it's one of those public-private partnership type deals, which seems like, you know, typical sort of bureaucratic approach. I would think it needs to be done though, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a very good thing that this hasn't resulted in the kind of, you know, what, internet kill switch, and I'm making air quotes here, that they were talking about previously. Other, you know, really stupid stuff like that, and ending up at something that sounds basically sensible, which is, you know, shock horror, critical infrastructure providers should work with government to not get them owned, right? I don't think that we're, you know, anyone would say that was a bad thing. So, yeah, hopefully the result of this is that, you know, there is some money involved and people... you know, do actually get the hell on with it instead of arguing about, you know, crappy ideas like internet kill switches.
Yeah, yeah. So it just seems like, you know, run-of-the-mill, boring regulatory stuff instead of like, yeah, we're going to shut off your tubes. Now, here's an interesting piece. A whole bunch of iTunes users are apparently getting refunds because their like iTunes credit just got absolutely drained. So some people are speculating... You know, just they're speculating on just quite how this happened. What's your take on this?
You know, it does suggest that, you know, a reasonable thing could be, you know, it's password and account reuse being leveraged from other, you know, other sites having their details stolen, like the Steam hack, for example. You know, taking all those accounts and reusing them against every other web property, especially ones that handle things in real money, is going to result in something that kind of looks like this. You know, money being stolen from a small number of accounts in fairly, you know, high-profile systems. So, yeah, that's kind of, you know, my gut feeling, but, you know, who really knows with the way that Apple keeps the lid on this?
Yeah, their PR philosophy is just a blanket no comment on pretty much anything. So, you know, I don't even know why they have PR people, to be honest. It's a bit of a...
Well, exactly, yeah. We all know what they're going to say.
Exactly, no comment. Yeah, no, I mean, if I had to guess, I'd say it's probably something along those lines as well. Now let's move on to this week's victims. Cryptome got pwnzored and was spreading out some malware. I mean, this is a fairly typical sort of attack here, nothing really that exciting.
Yeah, I mean, the technical nature of the attack, fairly straightforward. Like, somebody got write access to the disk of Cryptome, dropped code into the PHP files that render the site that direct people off to some malware hosted in Poland, and yeah, people were getting owned. Apparently, the system was logging the IPs of people it was attacking, so it was something like, what, 3,000 IPs were reportedly in the log. So it's not a massive compromise, but the sort of people who read Cryptome, I guess, are either nut jobs or spooks. So, you know, if you get some small percentage of spooks. Or bugs, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I guess you just have to be as careful browsing Cryptome as you are browsing any other service. On to the next victims now. The CIA got DDoSed by a bunch of Anons. Hooray, that's the second time. I think Lulzsec did that previously. I guess it is kind of lulzy, DDoSing the CIA. I would have thought they'd have some sort of DDoS prevention in there already, but I guess they just... don't give a shit.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Like, you go and go look at read the CIA's brochureware and you can't for half an hour because someone's throwing some packets around. Like, you know, whoop the f and do.
Also, a United Nations website was defaced apparently by someone going by the handle, a group going by the name of Cassie. They owned the United Nations and, I don't know, released some information on vulnerabilities in the site. Nothing really that exciting. I guess a little bit more interesting is Foxconn, makers of Apple's products like the iPhone and whatnot. They got popped by a group called Swag Security, who did a wonderful job of publishing all of the compromised credentials all over Pastebin and whatnot. So that was kind of a big deal. I'm sure they're running around like headless chickens dealing with that.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, any intrusion into Foxconn is going to be particularly concerning to their downstream customers like Apple, I guess, most notably. And, you know, Foxconn being a target, I guess, makes sense given all the publicity about the working conditions and stuff there in the factories where they manufacture all the shiny Apple kit. But, yeah, I guess this is going to be, a bit of a problem for them.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So they're probably just running around trying to tighten everything up. And I suppose once all of your usernames and passwords have been smattered all over the internet, it's a little bit difficult to, get your border back, let us say.
I think it's long gone.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, speaking of getting your border back, speaking of getting worked over pretty hard, earlier this week you linked me to an article appearing in the Wall Street Journal written by Siobhan Gorman, who's covers this sort of stuff. For them, I mean, she's written stuff about the Joint Strike Fighter program having data exfiltrated through it. They're all a smart grid being owned by the Chinese. That was all her stuff. Some people say she overcooks her pieces a little bit, but this one seems quite detailed, and it's about a suspected intrusion into Nortel that lasted something like 10 years. And I suppose the damning part of this is that Nortel apparently knew about it and didn't really care or do much to repel the attack.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. I mean, Nortel obviously were very big in the carrier and phone world some time ago. Obviously, they've fallen from grace a little bit lately. And according to the story, they got compromised, something like 10 years ago and have been systemically compromised ever since. And some of the discussions with people who worked there in the past said that they, they would treat the incident response on a case-by-case basis rather than really looking at any overall trend. So they would see, a bunch of systems get compromised by one particular piece of malware, clean that up, and then not really go and look to see, what else might be compromised with something different. And the attackers would, the allegation is that it's the same attackers dropping, lots of different varieties of malware, waiting for one to get cleaned up and then moving on to the next one and, effectively regaining access through a different mechanism and doing so, over a very, very long period of time, which, sounds like the sort of APT style operation that, we would absolutely expect to be occurring against, a big telco manufacturer. But yeah, the fact that they handled the response badly and then, the discussion in the article of how they didn't disclose the fact that they had been compromised, or they didn't consider the fact that they had been compromised a material thing to disclose whilst they're in the process of breaking up the company and selling it. That is, I guess, pretty concerning for some of the people who've bought Nortel assets and Nortel equipment.
Yeah, indeed. And I guess, I don't know, do you think it's fair of me to say that they didn't care about the breaches or because that implies that they were sort of deliberately not paying it attention, or does it just look like a standard sort of up in terms of their response?
Well, I don't think that 10 years ago, even, 5 years ago, there was as much understanding amongst, kind of C-level people of the widespread nature of espionage, of computer-assisted espionage, and especially in the high-tech industry. Maybe they didn't realize. Maybe it did just look like, getting infected by common garden viruses. Remember, it's taken us a while to get from the idea that a virus is just something that propagates and occasionally deletes things to, modern Trojan malware, that really is about remote access and espionage. Maybe that's taken a while to sink in up in the C-suite. Maybe it's just up, maybe it's cover up, maybe who really knows. Obviously, I guess Occam's razor comes down on the side of incompetence more than anything else.
Yeah, it does. But I guess if we really wanted to sum it up, long story short, Nortel got owned hard. The end. Now, speaking of people who got owned hard, Strat4, as we know, all of their subscriber list got out there. And of course, some bad guys have got a hold of it. They've dummied up a malware-laden PDF with, attention, important message for Strat4 subscribers and, hosed it out to all of the people on that list. I mean, there's really no surprise here. This is a standard sort of
really
response,
isn't.
Right?
And I suppose the fact that the PDF they sent out, was allegedly discussing the threats from phishing, from the mailing list being stolen, and the threats from getting malware.
Yeah, it's a bad guy with a keen sense of irony.
Well, exactly, yeah. So really, really no surprises when you're getting a PDF warning you might get phished that's phishing you. No surprises there.
Oh, there was an interesting little blog post that surfaced this week from Semantic. I'm actually in the process of trying to chase down the guy who wrote it because we'd like to have him on the show maybe in a couple of weeks. About this Android botnet that they found in China, which spread through, and keep in mind just how many people and devices there are in China, it spread through the app stores over there and is used to send premium SMSs, which might only be a few cents a pop in China. But when you're looking at the scale at which these things are sent via these compromised devices, it very quickly adds up. So Symantec have estimated that this Android botnet is earning whoever wrote it up to $3 million a year.
Yeah, that's you know, that's serious money in anyone's book.
Well, and Adam, the thing is, when I first read that, I thought that's got to be bullshit. So I clicked through to the blog post, and the reasoning is actually, you know, solid. I mean, all of these vendors love to say, "Oh my God, the bad guys are making X amount," but you look at their, you know, they basically prove that this is what's happening.
Well, yeah, I would entirely believe it. As you said, like the amount of devices in China and the amount of devices that are getting compromised. Yeah, it's not surprising that you could make, what, $10K a day US, you know, on premium rate scams. That's entirely believable, sadly.
Yeah. So, good for them. the Australian Parliament, this is kind of, you know, this is one of those, huh, stories, which kind of bothers me because I'm on a .biz domain, which is, you know, normally regarded as a bit of a den of, you know, malware nastiness. But, the Australian Parliament has blocked .info domains coming in and out of the Australian Parliament House network.
Yeah, I mean, you read this and you think, oh, well, that's, you know, that's just f***ing stupid. But I mean, on the other hand, I guess, you know, .info really is a hive of scum and villainy. And, you know, maybe it does make sense to just go around blocking .ru and .ro and .info, you know, because what plausible use could your parliamentarians have from, you know, reading about South American things?
South American things.
Well, I'm just thinking like you block you know, .ar and .br because those are filled with script kiddies.
Mm. Oh, them's fighting words. Don't get us owned.
Totally going to get us owned.
Apparently, though, they've unblocked access to 68.info sites on request. But it is interesting, isn't it, that an entire class of domain just gets dropped. Very quickly, we're just going to work through the patches over the last week. Of course, there's some Microsoft patches out there. Patch Tuesday criticals, get onto them. Adobe has also issued a out-of-band sort of zero-notice patch for Flash because they noticed it was being exploited out there. It was a cross-site scripting bug in Flash that was being exploited in the wild, so they decided just to put out a patch. I think this is funny, and look, I know there's going to be listeners out there who are going to say, you're only being nice to them because Adobe's a sponsor now, but there is this one quote in here from the Encircle guy who says, oh, well, in a perfect world, it would have been nice to get a little advanced communication about the zero day in Flash. And it's like, hang on, you're bitching because they did patch it? What the
Yeah, really?
Come on. Now, look, before we go, there is one thing here that you drew my attention to over the week, which is this blog post from Trustwave, and it's a CA policy update, and it's kind of lulzy. I would very much appreciate it if you could walk our listeners through Trustwave's Spider Labs blog post.
Yeah, so Trustwave, amongst other things, are a root CA. They have the ability to issue and sign CA certificates that are trusted by all the major browsers. And at some point, they announced publicly that they were not going to anymore issue wildcard certs, wildcard intermediate CA certs to their customers. And everyone kind of took a step back and went, hang on, what? You're not going to anymore? That implies at some point in the past, you've been issuing wildcard CA, you know, wildcard intermediate CA certs to people. And this is a certificate that would allow you to generate and sign a certificate for anything, a legitimate, valid certificate for anything yourself. And they came out with this blog post and said, actually, yes, we've given these, or given at least one, to one of our customers who was running a man-in-the-middle, SSL man-in-the-middling DLP solution that was in their organization, in the customer's organization, man-in-the-middling every SSL and logging it and looking for things being leaked out. And this is kind of up.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, so basically they gave a customer a cert that would allow them to man in the middle star dot star.
Yeah, with, and obviously generate no browser warnings in the process. And this is, like, not only is this a you know, catastrophically bad idea to start with, like completely defeats the point of the CA trust model. It's also against the policy of most of the browser vendors. For example, the Mozilla Foundation has a very strict policy that says explicitly that you can't do this if you want to be in the Mozilla root trust store. And so there was a bunch of, you know, discussion that came out from this, you know, suggesting that the TrustWave CA cert ought to be booted out of Mozilla, out of Firefox, which would have a very big impact, obviously, on everybody who uses TrustWave certified sites, and their list of customers is very big, lots of US military and things. But this is, you know, really provoked a big discussion about, you know, exactly to what extent, you know, is the CA system so utterly broken when the CAs are issuing wildcard certs to their customers?
Wildcard certs that for the internet, we're not just talking about star.yourdomain.com. This is a internet-wide wildcard.
Yeah, and can you imagine stealing one of those? Like, what would that be worth? If I could bust into the device and steal it, right?
And less and less claiming, now that the browser manufacturers are starting to pin certs for, like, you know, the top 100 mail providers and stuff. I mean, it is a problem that, like, because it's gone so far down the crackhead path, it's actually got a lot better. We have to say that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I just can't help but think, like, you get one of those plus evil grade and you own the internet, you know? It's just...
Sounds good. Sounds like my kind of gig. Let's do it, man.
Yeah. You know, it's just, it's classic, you know, likelihood probably pretty low, severity so and high, what were you thinking?
Yeah, let's we could buy an island.
Well, exactly.
We could buy Ireland.
We could buy Ireland and call it Risky Bizland, you know? You really it's just
sweet.
Such a valid. And of course, on the other hand, right, kudos to TrustWave for coming out and saying we're not going to do it anymore.
Man,
right,
I mean, can you admit admitting something that crackheaded takes serious cojones, man?
Yeah, and of course every other CA is probably doing the same thing and hasn't come out and admit it. And that's really the only thing saving them,
Don't say that, man. That's frightening. Frightening.
Well, let's be realistic. Of course they are. Like, you think the Chinese CA isn't signing everything?
Oh, you mean the Shanghai Digital Certificate Authority and all those guys in there that you've never heard of? That's fantastic. China Post. Yeah, thanks, guys.
But
that's good.
But no, really, the fact they came out and said they're not going to do it anymore and admitted that they had done it in the past is the only thing that's saving them from being delisted from the Mozilla Root Trust store, you know, judging by the discussion on the Mozilla Bugzilla. About this particular thing. But yeah, this is bad. Like, it really is bad. And, you know, anytime we discuss quite how badly the CA infrastructure is failing in the next, you know, 10 years, this is going to come up. Right? It's that bad.
It's all manner of, right. Well, seven shades of fail, rainbow fail. If you will, right there. Adam, that's all we're going to have time for this week in the news. That's it. Pleasure chatting as always, mate. And we'll pick it up again next week.
I'll see you then, Pat.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Before we move on to this week's feature interview, I got some great email from listener Hans Duploy from London, who wrote in with his perspectives on SPF, or Sender Policy Framework. He reckons last week's guest, Paul Ducklin, was a little bit off when it came to some of his perspectives on Sender Policy Framework, and he wanted to set the record straight from his point of view. So with Hans's permission, I posted his email as a comment on last week's podcast post. Go have a read of that if, you know, reading about SPF is your thing. You know, if you work in hosting or for a webmail provider or something like that, you might find it pretty interesting. Now, also last week, Paul Ducklin mentioned that Apple's SPF policy allowed its mail to come from the entire Class A, starting with like 17 dot. Well, as it turns out, listener Connor Power has written in to point out that Apple, in fact, owns that entire range. Not only that, apparently HP owns 15 dot and 16 dot. So there you go. You learn something new every day. There's some companies out there using a lot of IPs that they don't need. Now, also via email, I've been asked to announce the call for papers for B-Sides Charleston, which will take place April 13 to 14 at the College of Charleston campus. You can Google around for more info. Now, as usual, Risky Business sponsorship inquiries need to go to Patrick at risky.biz, as do all of your inquiries for the security jobs that I have going in Australia. We've got pen testing gigs in Melbourne, Sydney, Perth, Canberra. We're looking for incident responders, malware analysts. Let me know. Write to me, Patrick at risky.biz. And it is time. Finally, it is time, after all of that, for this week's feature interview. And we are chatting, as we mentioned at the top of the show, with Dan Gear. Dan is the Chief Security Officer of InQtel, a rather interesting organization, which is tasked with investing in technology that is likely to be of use to intelligence agencies in the US. It was actually set up by the Central Intelligence Agency. Dan has a history in InfoSec that stretches back quite a long way, you know, working for Vertisys, for Atstake, for a whole bunch of people. He's widely regarded as a real luminary on this stuff, and he's certainly one of my favourite guests to have on the program. Now, earlier this week, Dan and I had a wide-ranging discussion on everything from, you know, metadata mining to facial recognition and surveillance. Now, I've had to break the conversation up into two parts because it's just too long to insert into one podcast. So we're playing part one this week and part two next week. In this week's segment, Dan kicks things off with the observation that when we broadcast something wirelessly, we must expect that it will be surveilled and recorded. Here he is.
Well, a radio signal, you know, putting aside that the universe is infinite and all of that, a radio signal goes a long way, and the real question is, what's the quality of the antenna? And if you start broadcasting something, it's hard to argue that someone who is receiving it improperly. And yes, I know there are various people who have rules about you can't eavesdrop on this, that, or the other, but what's the practical effect of that? And I would suggest the practical effect of that is largely nothing. And we are, of course, investing in radios in lots of things now, really, rather a lot of them. And so if the transmissions are not themselves in some other way protected, the mere fact that you put it up, there's no reason for you to expect that it isn't, it won't be listened to. You had a funny remark about that, as I remember.
I can't remember where I heard that one, but yes, I didn't steal your Wi-Fi. It was trespassing on my property.
Correct. Well, the wiretap laws in the U.S. Date back actually to an interval in which there was the argument around so-called party lines, where everybody in a rural setting shared one wire, and it was distinctive ring that said that this if it's two longs and a short when it rings, that's for me. If it's three shorts, it's for one of my neighbors, etc. But there was no way to prevent other people from picking up the phone. And at first, that was thought of, well, it's just a feature of the medium. Don't complain. And it was only much, much, much later that the idea that it was unlawful to intercept came in. That originally it was simply thought that you're sending signals off of your land on a wire that is shared with others, you should not expect anything other than it would be listened to. And, you know, in a way, that's far more logical.
Yes, it is. But I'm wondering if we can draw parallels between these wired and wireless sort of shared access medium propositions and the wider internet and the digital world more broadly. When we post something on Twitter, we may as well be transmitting it via an extremely powerful antenna. Would you agree with that proposition?
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that proposition, that there's no calling it back. And, you know, you should ask yourself, is that what you want to leave behind when you're gone? Or, you know, I mean, in a way, announcing human civilization is the earliest radio programs are now, whatever they are, 100 light years out into space. And so we are... We're announcing who we are that way, and there's no calling it back.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It should make us think perhaps a little bit more carefully about some of our programming decisions.
Well, sure. I mean, when the people on when the people way out there, whoever they are, actually get War of the Worlds.
Oh, I was just saying, it's funny. I was just thinking the exact same thing. It was on television here. The movie version, the recent movie version, was on TV the other night. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking the exact same thing. They're going to be mighty confused and probably a little nervous.
Right.
So when we think about this, idea of you publish it, you broadcast that it is open to surveillance. I mean, who are the most likely candidates to violate this sort of, you know, this made up abstract right that we think we have to not be surveilled? Do you think it's going to be other citizens? Do you think it's going to be the state? Do you think it's going to be criminals? Is it going to be a nice sort of blend of all of them?
Well, probably the blend, although I will say that, and this is, of course, a broad generalization, and generalizations are what they're worth. But in the 90s, the commercial sector largely caught up with the mill sector in the application of cryptography. I don't mean the testing of it or the invention of it or the business about crafting new algorithms or anything like that. I just mean the use of it in, for example, applications. And I think we're presently watching the commercial world begin to catch up in traffic analysis. And traffic analysis is viable whether or not you are, for example, encrypting your messages. If I'm encrypting my messages, but it's still interesting to know whether I'm home or not, you don't have to be able to hear what the message content is. You can tell whether I'm at home. Mm. And it's that idea that I think is more interesting with respect to radio transmissions and the like, is it enables traffic analysis, and do we care? Has there not been some discussion of detecting traffic jams by looking at location information from the cellular networks?
You know, if
all the cars are seeming to pile up and everybody has a cell phone, then obviously you can detect a traffic jam at a distance without having to either listen to people's conversations or be able to visualize what's going on. You've got it. I mean, that's a simple example, and I don't mean to make a pun on the word traffic analysis here, but that's a simple example.
It is. I mean, I saw a very interesting presentation at the RuxCon conference in Melbourne just this last November, which looked at doing traffic analysis on someone's Google Maps session. And they were using some pretty primitive techniques, but they were able to really narrow down and figure out what someone was looking at, roughly what someone was looking at by just examining the HTTPS connections between the client and Google. So there was an example where you could actually make some inferences as to the content of the message just by looking at traffic analysis.
And I don't doubt that that will get better. The people in the marketing world have, in so many words, every reason to try to make the most of what data they can get on whomever. I unfortunately lost the URL for this. I'm sure it could be found again. But in writing an article yesterday, in fact, I ran across something, and then, as I say, I lost the URL, but it was talking about the data volumes of what they referred to as digital exhaust. The data volumes for that probably exceed the data volumes of the actual transaction itself. So if I send you a message that says, hello, there's not a lot of there are not many bits involved in saying hello.
Mm.
On the other hand, setting up the connection, doing the routing, latency issues, there's a lot of other meta information that can be extracted from the mere fact that I sent you the word hello, and I might send you the word hello in a language that no one else speaks, and so they wouldn't know it was hello. But the digital exhaust, which was the term of art that I thought was rather nice, digital exhaust of that is in fact both much larger and independent of message content, which strikes me as, well, that's the definition of traffic analysis, after all, is it's independent of content. So it may well be that throwing off, whether it's radio or other things, but I think radio is especially obvious, but throwing off metadata just by the fact that you are using it may well have inferential capacity much bigger than we thought. You will recall that there are people who've been able to, in effect, decode what you were typing by listening to your keystrokes. Now, you might, first say, well, that's impossible, but the answer is no. I mean, the pattern of keystrokes is one that is relevant to language. The language has some keys, some words are more common than others, and some of them type easier than others. And if you work on it, evidently you can get a good idea of what someone's typing just by listening to the keystrokes. That's an example of exploiting the meta-analysis, and it seems to me that in a world that gets richer in radios, the availability of metadata must surely increase.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about what can be inferred versus what we think we're implying, and this is something that I happily had a little chat about on a panel once. I was sitting there, believe it or not, a panel about digital privacy at a music festival here in Australia called Splendor in the Grass. So it's quite a funny experience to be up there with a few musicians and a couple of other sort of tech pundits. And there was a writer named Marie Cardi, who's a bit of an Australian sort of celebrity writer and TV personality. And she was saying, well, I control what it is that I put out there on social networks. I'm managing my persona. I don't feel that my privacy is violated. I put it to her that people might be able to infer more from what she's publishing than what she was deliberately attempting to imply. Now, it seems to me that you're taking this to the next sort of logical step and looking at not just what someone like that is intending to imply, but also the associated metadata around it.
Well, and there's lots of it, and we are no longer suffering from the cost aspect of, well, there's just too much of it, we can't afford to store it, there's no place to put it. That really isn't the case anymore. There always is now some place to put it. In fact, to the degree to which the intelligence community, just like the commercial community, is suffering from, if you will, I won't say too much data, because for many of these people, there's no such thing as too much data, but data that is so voluminous that some degree of automation of its analysis is a very worthwhile endeavor to put one's time into, to make it possible to automatedly analyze that. And my guess would be that we'll see more and more of that, again, with the metadata. The if I walk through a shopping mall and you knew nothing more than where my footfalls were, you could say something to the various stores about which ones I looked at and, you know, what caught my eye and who I walked right by and so forth. And that isn't, strictly speaking, private. You shouldn't expect to be private. You're in a public place, et cetera. But the ability to infer that from signals, I guess I should even call it signals intelligence, shouldn't I? The ability to refer that from SIGINT, because we are now, so many of us carry radios, and so many things we have radios in them, we are pushing ordinary life into the area that had previously been, in effect, reserved for intelligent activities. Take our friends in Britain, where, as I understand it, in London, there really are not a lot of intersections that don't have a camera in some sense.
Well, I think every square inch of the real central London is covered with CCTV.
Right. I think that's correct. It's just pretty much always there. And we can put aside for a moment the value of that for forensics, which I don't imagine is disputable, that there's probably quite a lot of value for forensics.
But, well, I'm sure if we had everyone chipped, that would be handy as well. But
well, of course it would be handy, and yeah. I can come back to that if you like. but the camera, the infrastructure for the cameras, that is to say the fact that they have poles and they have mounting blocks and they have electricity and they have wires or whatever it is that runs back to some place that collects it. And in other words, the infrastructure of the camera environment could be easily augmented for example, if you... And I don't know whether Britain is requiring this. Certainly the U.S. is requiring that automobiles have Bluetooth-based tire pressure sensors in all their tires so that there will be a warning light on your dash if one of your tires is low. This strikes me as a crazy thing to bother with, but nevertheless, it's law, and you can't sell a car now in the U.S. that doesn't have tire sensors that will light up a light on your dashboard if a tire is low, and... of course, it has to be radio, because what are you going to attach it to otherwise? You know, a tire spinning around at, let's say you're going 50 miles an hour, you're going 100 kilometers an hour, or whatever it is, there's no way to, you're not going to make another bearing to attach a wire to that. So let's just assume for the moment that that is a radio. Well, that radio, of course, if your dash wants to know which tire it is, radio needs to have an ID. So in fact, the radios have separate IDs per tire.
Yeah,
that's
so you've
fine.
Got basically a unique Bluetooth address on all four wheels broadcasting
right.
into
so,
the ether.
So why bother with, you know, skip the cameras in London? I don't need to read anything. I can just follow. All I need is a good enough Bluetooth antenna.
Yeah, and you can capture unique IDs belonging to unique vehicles. I mean, I can imagine that there's some listeners to this program who might have Bluetooth tire sensors in their cars who have maybe already figured out how to change the hardware ID on them. I get that this is creepy, okay? And it's tip of the iceberg creepy. Just before we continue down this track, because there's a lot that I want to talk about in terms of some developments in this part of the world with police doing automatic number plate recognition and things like that, or license plate recognition. It's what you'd say in the US. Before we get to that, though, you gave the example just earlier of someone walking around a shopping center. You know, you could gather a lot of intelligence, but just by looking at something they did, like, you know, the position of their feet, you could tell where they went, what they looked at, what drew their attention. Now, one of the things that's been, that I guess has previously stopped marketeers from doing these sorts of things, is it would be technically fiddly to make that happen. But I'm wondering, with a move to technologies like NFC, whether or not it's going to remain fiddly. And I can see the marketing benefits of something like NFC are pretty amazing. I mean, you could buy $30 worth of dollars for 20 for your local sushi bar, you know, through some sort of coupon offer, and then use that at their point of sale terminal. You could walk up to a billboard with an NFC capability and hold your phone up to a billboard in order to get zapped a free coffee at the Starbucks in that mall, right? There's some really interesting applications there. But I guess, does this feed in? Do you see NFC and technologies like NFC eventually enabling that sort of scenario that you spoke about, that enable them to track us through the mall? And, you know, the benefit to us might be that we might get a free sandwich, or we might, you know, get some discount or something.
This will sound somewhat petty, and I don't really mean it that way, but every time you see something that amounts to actual price discovery, I'm going to speak like an economist for a second. Anytime you look at something that amounts to actual price discovery on how people value the, if you want to call it that, their privacy, I don't know if that's even the right word. The answer is it's pretty cheap.
Mm.
You know, if you will fill out this questionnaire, we'll give you a dollar. I mean, or you will, or for that matter, if you will, just as you say, hold up your mobile to a billboard that has a product code embedded in it, however it's embedded. We'll give you 50 cents off a cup of coffee. Yeah, you know, and the answer, of course, is, amongst other things, you're telling whether or not that billboard caught people's eyes.
Mm.
You know, a lot of websites have, a lot of advertising websites, you know, rotate ads in an experimental sense. You know, which ones work better is something that is inherent in the way they do that. It's unsurprising. It should have surprised no one. It isn't that everybody sees the, what can I pick here? Everybody sees the ad for this particular brand of camping gear or something. Everybody sees it, and no, that isn't the case. You may well be seeing something that's different than everybody else, and more to the point, every marketeer wants you to see something that's different than everybody else because they want it tailored to your taste, and they want to learn that over time, and you are, you know, voluntarily, and you're paid for it. I would suggest you're paid not much, but you're paid to be a lab animal in that sense.
So I guess what we're saying here is that 1984, much to our surprise, is an opt-in proposition.
Well, it could be. It certainly could be. And as I say, and I'm not making fun of anyone when I say this, but it is the case that most people will sell their information in that sense, in the sense we're talking about, will sell that information for, in fact, very little money.
Mm.
Very little money indeed. Now, that is not the ordinary kind of transaction, and so I'm not claiming that people actually think, do I care that anybody knows where I am right now? Well, no, that's worth 25 cents or whatever it is. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it does not seem intuitively natural for folks to say, I've just sold information for this. It wasn't that I got this for free. You didn't get it for free. You traded, if nothing else, the digital exhaust of the transaction that allowed you to get the coupon. You traded that for the coupon. And our friends in marketing have every reason to get better and better and better at that. And it is getting better at that is little different than what, as you said a moment ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, would have been thought to be a high-end intelligence activity.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's...
Because now it can be automated. You don't have to have a dozen faceless people wandering around doing ordinary things and with one eye peeled for the person of interest. It's inherent in the technologic infrastructure. You don't have to deploy, you know, 15 well-trained agents who can blend in and not tip off the mark.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's wholesale and it's easy. And I suppose governments and powerful organizations have never been able to engage in this sort of activity to the scale that is possible now. I mean, the cost has just reduced exponentially. I mean, it's just mind-boggling how cheap it is now to do this sort of stuff. And
it is so cheap that it is so cheap to collect that the act of collecting it produces the problem of I've got too much.
Yeah.
Where, just as you say, 15 years ago it would be, where can I get this? And now it's the, would you turn off the fire hose, please?
Yes. Dan Gear there. Now, look, as for tire pressure sensors, I think, you know, some are Bluetooth and others are CAN bus and stuff, but whatever. I think, you know, his point stands that a lot of these things have unique IDs and can be recorded. I just find it fascinating stuff. I always find chatting with Mr. Dan Gear fascinating. And of course, we will bring you part two of that interview on next week's show. Now, as we mentioned earlier, this week's episode is made possible only through the sponsorship of RSA Security. So a big thank you to them. And you all know out there in listener land how this works. Each week we get our sponsors to come onto the show to talk about something current. And this week it's RSA Security's Mason Hooper, who's joining us to talk about RSA's 2012 Cybercrime Trends Report. It's an interesting little look at what the banking and finance sector might be in for in 2012 when it comes to all things cybercrime. One of the most interesting findings in the report is that the Zeus family of crimeware is still top dog, as Mason explains.
We did see some emergence of some new Trojans. We saw ICE 1X gain some momentum, but it has slowed down quite a bit. It didn't really offer much about above Zeus and was based on 98% of the code. But Zeus is still the killer Trojan out there, and it's responsible for, we believe, 80% of financial losses.
So it is the Rolls-Royce of crimeware.
Yeah, absolutely. And because that source code leaked, there's so many plugins for Zeus. It's just a very efficient Trojan.
And, of course, Zeus has gone well and truly multi-platform these days, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing it in the mobile space, and there's a lot of work going on there. One of the things we mentioned in the report last year in the mobile space was that we were starting to see Zeus redirecting SMSs on those mobile platforms. And there was a bit of, as I was talking to different financial institutions, you know, some of them were not quite sure how that would go through 2011. They didn't think it would be as prevalent as it was. Because they thought, some of them thought it would be difficult to infect both the PC and the mobile. But, you know, it worked out that was quite easy. Zeus is packaged with tools now that when the user goes to the banking site, it will bring up a request saying that we need to load some more software onto your mobile phone, either digital certificate or some security software. So they get the user to put in the mobile number and the manufacturer of the phone. It just then spits out an SMS to the phone and gets them to download the malware. So it's quite easy for Zeus to get to attack both platforms, and that's very prevalent. One thing we saw a little bit of at the end of last year was that Zeus is starting to collect information and other Trojans on the mobile, and this is what we see all the time in the PC space, that they're information gathering Trojans. We didn't see a lot of that in the mobile space, but that will certainly increase this year. It's already starting to roll out across the industry.
Rightio. Now, another trend that we're looking at here, and it's kind of an interesting one, is you guys reckon that criminals are trying to find new ways to monetize non-financial data. Now, a few of the examples here are things like utility statements, which contain a lot of information that might be usable in, you know, advanced forms of identity fraud, like bank accounts, mortgages, things like that. And also medical records to facilitate sort of medical insurance fraud.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen quite a bit of that. The medical insurance fraud, we've seen that primarily based in the US, but we expect to see that flow out to other regions. But that information, it's actually quite interesting how expensive it can be, because it can be up to $1 to $3 per record, but for that PI information. So that can obviously be used in a lot of other attacks. The banks are all clamping down with other types of authentication, so it's increasingly difficult for the fraudsters to go and be able to get money and cash out. So they're using this PI information to go and get that other, redirect someone's phone or change their banking details via a help desk and be able to act as if they are that user. So information is power, and the guys are out there, the fraudsters are monetizing it.
And you've also got stuff here, which is, I mean, it stands to reason, but, you know, compromised user accounts and access, you know, like shells on compromised, you know, end user computers that then someone else might be able to leverage into that sort of information if they can be bothered putting in the work. But it seems like, yeah, any compromised box will do these days. You can just sell the credentials.
Absolutely. And those compromised boxes are very valuable because, you know, the banks are doing their fraud detection based on a lot of things like geolocation and also other attacks. are being prevented by things like geolocation. So selling access to infected machines is hugely useful, and we are seeing much more of the manual style attacks. We mentioned that in the anti-Trojan space. Traditionally, the man in the browser type attacks have all been automated. So from the infection point, as soon as someone goes to the bank, to their bank account and logs in, the scripting is there to just transfer money out without any intervention. That's getting harder because obviously that leaves some sort of a footprint that the banks can, or a signature that the banks can start detecting. So we're seeing a lot more of that manual intervention, which is obviously slower, but it's worth the return for the fraudsters.
Especially when they can do stuff like, you know, one of the problems the banks are running into, I understand, is that they really place a lot of trust in users that have been authenticated with a second factor, like an SMS. So then they can do things like high-value transactions to wherever, which means that if you can compromise that second factor, it's basically carte blanche. Is that the case? Because I understand you guys are looking at this as an issue for 2012.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the financial institutions out there will start reconsidering that because as those attacks become more and more prevalent and those second factors, while they're never easy to compromise, they're getting easier and easier. So they will have to reduce those limits again and look for alternatives.
And what are those alternatives going to look like? I mean, that's the problem. We're kind of running out of second factors at the moment. I mean, you know, key fobs, like, you know, RSA tokens or, you know, whichever manufacturer, Vasco or whatever, they're of limited use against man-in-browser malware. SMS, I mean, we've seen organized criminals being able to reprovision people's phone numbers onto different SIM cards so they can capture authentication tokens. So, you know, what's the future of that sort of, what's the way around this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's still a fair amount that we can do with SMS. There's databases that exist to show we can detect when something's been call forwarded. We can detect some things like if someone transfers their mobile phone to another network. That's a good indication that fraud has occurred there. There's some databases that exist that we can look at and help with our fraud evaluation. So there's a lot more transaction-based monitoring and detection that the banks are doing to try and get around that. So they will look to improve that out-of-band authentication, but they'll look at other methods. You know, transaction signing tokens may be the way to go for those higher value accounts and those higher value transactions. And also they're doing a lot in the risk-based protection. So there's all sorts of behavioral patterns to a transaction. The banks are increasing their efforts there, and they'll use that to supplement those out-of-band authentications.
How are numbers looking? I mean, with the information that you guys have access to, because you do work with a number of financial institutions, is the amount that they're losing to malware like Zeus fairly static on an annualized basis, or is it going up? Is it going down? Like, what is the current state of play?
Yeah, sure. We see it trending up on a year-to-year basis. Particularly, Trojans have evolved quite a bit. Previously, it was just pure phishing that banks were losing money from. They're pretty good at countering that now, although phishing is still very prevalent and they're still successful. And while ever they're successful, people will keep doing it. But definitely, we're seeing Trojans on the increase. And we see that, you know, as banks roll out things like chip and PIN, it's harder to swipe a card and take money using those physical methods.
So what you might lose on the online swings, you make up on the point of sale merry-go-round, so to speak.
Exactly right. So that tends to happen when banks tighten up a particular channel, you'll see it trend to another.
Okay, Mason Hooper, thank you for joining us to discuss the RSA 2012 Cybercrime Trends Report. It is available. If anyone out there would like to Google for it, you will find it, the RSA 2012 Cybercrime Trends Report. Thank you for joining us on the show, and we'll chat to you again later in the year.
Thanks for your time, Patrick.
Mason Hooper of RSA Security in this week's sponsor interview there. And big thanks again to RSA Security and in particular Joanne Aldrich from the Australian marketing team for making this week's episode possible. Now, this week's feature track is another one available through Hope Street Recordings. It is called Busted, and it's by the Putbacks. You can get this on iTunes as an MP3, or you could grab it from Hope Street Recordings on vinyl if you are into that sort of thing. And that is it for this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.